This Week in Retronauts, what is a man? Well, guys, what is it?
A miserable little pile of secrets.
Enough talk. Have at you. All right. Yes. Hi, everyone. What?
That's at the end when you kill
okay.
Him.
Okay. Okay. So, hi, everyone. Welcome to another Metroidvania episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and as usual, I have brought them here together to pay me tribute.
Oh, you stole it. That was going to be my intro.
Sorry about that, Chris. Go ahead.
I'm Chris Sims. What?
What?
And I am here to talk about the second best Metroidvania ever made after Super Mario World.
Oh, you just had to bring that in. And also here to be very specific about semantics. It's
Benj Edwards.
That's it?
That's all I got to say.
That's all you got? No, like, trouble my mother's soul no more, yeah. Anything like that.
You horrible monster. Mankind ill needs such a thing as you. I don't remember what he says.
What are we going to talk about this episode, guys?
We're going to talk about... I've got some great cookie recipes. I found one on the back of some chocolate cookies. Chips, like, on the back. It's so good. You guys should try it.
Chocolate chip.
Also, we're going to talk about something called Symphony of the Night. But, okay, so we have actually done a Retronauts on Rondo of Blood and Symphony of the Night about 3 or 4 years ago. So that's kind of fresh. I don't want to belabor that point too much. But on the other hand, I know you guys really love that game. So we're going to talk about it some in a larger context. This actually, okay, so this is our, what is it now, fifth episode on the evolution of Metroidvania style games. Is that better, Benj?
Yeah.
Metroidvania style.
Metroidvania-esque.
Yes, there you go.
Exploration-based action RPG platformers.
We exactly. Should just call them Parishvanias at this point.
They don't actually die. Well, actually, that's what we're going to talk about this episode, is that for a while, around the time of Symphony of the Night, this style of game pretty much vanished. Like, between the debut of Symphony of the Night and Metroid Fusion, 5.5 years later, you could count the number of these games, the style of game that were released into the market on like one hand. It's crazy. You know, you went from, as we talked about in the NES era, like there were years where you would have half a dozen of these games, and then to go 5 years and not even see half a dozen of them. Like, wow, what happened? We're going to talk about that. But first, we are going to kind of catch up with stuff we meant to talk about last episode, but ended up getting carried away with Chris's, virgin experience with Super Metroid, maiden experience. How's that? Your maiden voyage. Okay. That's getting a little less sketchy. Mm-hmm. Yes. But this time I'm sure we all have long deep seated love for Symphony of the Night. So we don't need to worry about fresh experiences. Instead, we can talk about old experiences. I don't know what I'm talking about. Last time we were going to talk about some 16-bit Metroidvania style games that kind of came before Super Metroid and after Super Metroid, and everything got kind of crowded out by Super Metroid. So we should catch up on those. We don't have to go into super detail in these, but it is interesting to see sort of how this genre continued to evolve after Super Metroid kind of perfected everything. Like, after Super Metroid, what more do you do? Where do you go from there? This is a problem that even Nintendo has faced, which is why none of the games to come after Super Metroid have been quite as good. But what can you do?
So you can be Konami and create Symphony of the Night.
You can. That's what happened.
Yeah. Spoiler. Spoiler alert.
So there are, what, like, I guess 4 games here worth kind of touching on in this first segment before we get to Symphony. And two of them are actually on Sega systems, and it's kind of an underrepresented sort of platform for this style of game. But in the 16-bit era, they kind of were like, hey, Nintendo's slacking. It's time for us to catch up and give the people what they need. Because Sega does what Nintendo don't, even with the style of game. So the first one is Popful Mail. No, actually, I guess Monster World 4. Sorry, I went out of order. Monster World 4. We've done a full episode on the Monster World series, and it's very confusing. This is the one that's not like any of the other Monster World games. It's not a total Metroidvania-style open-world platformer like Wonder Boy 3, but it's also not just strictly linear like the original Wonder Boy. It's kind of in between. And also, it's not Wonder Boy because it doesn't star a boy. It stars a girl. It stars a girl named Aisha, I think. And this game is very similar in a lot of ways to Shantae. Although, as you may have heard in the episode we just posted last week on Shantae, where I spoke to its creator, Matt Bozon, he said, no, actually, I'd never played Monster World 4 before we created Shantae. So it's like a crazy coincidence. But she is a girl who runs around. She has a sword, but she also hits things with her hair. There's exploration and kind of like a sort of middle Eastern art vibe. Also the game Iconoclasts, which just came out this past week. That also was heavily influenced by Monster World 4. So it's a game that kind of connects to a lot of other games and in interesting ways, but maybe unintentional ways. I don't know.
Now, is she also a digital avatar for Colonel Scott O'Connor?
She is not.
Okay.
There's nothing to do with Kabuki Quantum Fighter here.
Okay.
That's a good reference, though.
Yeah.
It's hair-based combat games.
There aren't a lot of those.
HBC.
You can... I'm worried that my house's HBC is going to wear out and it'll be expensive to replace.
Didn't it freeze last week?
It did. It's terrible. I don't know. I don't have too much to say about Monster World 4 because it is kind of an edge case. It's semi nonlinear, but it's really pretty linear.
What
it's
year
actually
is this?
1994.
Yeah, at this time in America. Did this even come out in America?
Not until like 2009.
Okay, so yeah, that's why I never heard of it until like this year or last year. And at that, you know, obviously Sonic games sort of overwhelmed everything on the Genesis, at least in the American market. So even Monster World 3, did that come out in America? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had no idea.
This was the first entry in the series that did not make it to the US.
Okay.
And for a long time, it was kind of like the Sega Genesis's hidden gem alongside Alien Soldier, the one by Treasure.
Yeah.
There's like Alien Storm and Alien Syndrome and Alien Soldier. And that's the one that's like all boss battles. Mm. And it's crazy hard. This was one of like two crazy hidden gems on the Sega Genesis or Mega Drive that importers knew about.
And it's still hidden.
It's not.
Because
Sega actually localized it for last gen platforms. It showed up on WiiWare and Xbox 360 PS3. As part of the Monster World collection. And it's actually playable on Xbox One and Wii U through backward compatibility. So on Wii U, you'll have to buy it like immediately if you want to play it through Wii backward compatibility.
So they're about to close the store?
Yes, they're about to close the digital storefront there. The storefront's going to be open for like another year, but you have like until the end of the month, which actually may be too late by the time you hear this, to put Wii points in to buy stuff. But the Xbox One backward compatibility seems to be ongoing, and it is supported. So if you want to check out Monster World 4, it's possible to do that on a current-gen system without, you know, bending over backward to do it. So I highly recommend it. It's a really cool game. But it is very much in sort of the cave story vein, where it kind of seems open-ended, but it's actually not. Like, you go from point A to point B. And there's some hidden stuff and a chance to kind of wander around and go back and forth. But really, you're just kind of going through the linear plot. Chris, you've been very quiet.
He disappeared.
You have nothing to say on this game.
I'm saving it up. I'm saving it up, Jeremy.
He's storing up his energy. You should see him sitting here squatting.
just Goku-ing.
Clenching his fists. Right now. Yeah, fireballs coming around.
Thank you.
So, Benj, you mentioned Sonic, and it's interesting you should mention Sonic because the next game we're going to talk about supposedly almost became a Sonic game, and that is Falcom's Popful Mail, which originally debuted on, I want to say, PC 9801 in Japan, but then it was ported to definitely Sega CD. That's Sega the version CD. That came to the US, and that was localized by Working Designs. And I think it also showed up on Super Famicom. And all three of these games were completely different from, not completely, but very different from one another. They had like the same sort of general vibe and gameplay, but they all had different structures. It's kind of weird. And as it happens, a listener named Brady Hartel wrote in with some very extensive notes. Oh yeah, here it is. He says, I have a physical copy of every version of the game except for the PC 88 version and the cell phone port. This is what I know that exists of. PC 88 debuted in 1991. It is, as far as I know, the first version. It's very simplistic sounding. It has a 640 by 200 resolution at 8 colors, but he says he's never been able to get that version to run. The PC 98 version from 92 is the PC 88 version with better graphics. It is 5 floppy disks long and runs at a better resolution, 640 by 400 at 16 colors. It's a simple scrolling platformer, which scrolls well enough for a PC 98 game, but it has that low frame rate jerkiness PC 98 games tend to have. The gameplay area is also pretty tiny and surrounded by HUD elements. I think they did this because they probably couldn't make the game full screen on PC 98. The biggest thing, which doesn't translate through videos about the gameplay, is that there's really only one action button other than the directional keys, and that's to jump. To attack enemies, you sort of bump into them and mail auto attacks. So it's very much like the East games, but as a platformer. Then the Sega CD Mega CD version launched in April 94. This is the version that Sega Falcom completely remade from the ground up that most people know. And supposedly this version was going to be released in the US under the name Sister Sonic, and it was going to somehow be tied to the Sonic series.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
This may be apocryphal. Brady says that he can't actually find firm information about that, but that it was mentioned apparently in an interview in a German magazine in the 90s. So who knows? Anyway, the level layout is expanded from the PC 98 version. Everything is bigger. All of it's redrawn. But the actual level layouts are pretty much the same. Let's see. Attacks are given their own buttons, and there are a bunch of weapons and armor with different effects. So that's the Metroidvania aspect of it, is the sort of RPG component to it. Also of note, in the Japanese version, is the introduction of Megumi Hayashibara as male. Male is really similar to Lina Inverse from Slayers as a character, so it feels kind of obvious why they cast her for that role. She's also the voice of male in many, many, many drama CDs. So should we mention who Megumi Hayashibara is here? Surely you know, Chris.
I am unfamiliar.
What? How could you be unfamiliar, what? Mr. Sailor Moon podcast guy? Surely she was in Sailor Moon. She's got to have been. Megumi Hayashibara was, she was like the voice of hot-headed women in anime in the 90s. She probably still is. I don't know. I'm kind of stopped following anime. But she was Faye Valentine in Cowboy Bebop. Okay. She was female Ranma in Ranma One Half. She was, let's see, Lina Inverse. She was, I want to say she was Asuka in Evangelion.
Asuka the Grouch?
No, stop. You're terrible. Anyway, so yeah. I can't believe you don't know.
Does not look like she was in a Sailor Moon. She was Tira in Sorcerer Hunters.
Huh.
Which was a manga and anime that I had a weird affection for in the mid-90s. But yeah, it does not look like she was a Sailor Moon actress.
Huh, okay, well, I stand corrected then.
She was in basically everything else.
Though. Yeah, like she was
everywhere. Bulbasaur.
Oh, yeah?
Wow. Yeah.
Bulbasaur.
Huh. Yeah, exactly. You are you Megumi Hayashibara?
Yes. I have no idea.
Who knew this would be the day where we find out Benj's hidden talent for voice acting and singing?
All right, so Popful Mail also showed up on Super Famicom in June 94, yet another version built from the ground up, and the level layouts diverge much more from the source than the Sega CD. But this time it was done in-house by Falcom. There are a lot of differences. For instance, you run into the character Tot, who's like a little dragon, in the very first town. And I believe there are added characters like Muttonhead has a granddaughter that only appears in this and the radio dramas. It's somewhat similar to the Sega CD version in that it has a separate attack button and bigger full-screen graphics, but the sprite animations are very weak, and I think it's not as fun as the Sega CD one or PC Engine Super CD one. I think the reason there's never been a fan translation of this is because there's some heavy encryption on the sprites. That's interesting. And then finally, we're not going to talk about the cell phone version. Yeah, right?
Never heard of that.
That's some of those. Yeah, some of those Super NES games had some weird encryption on them. Like Star Ocean took forever to localize because there was like all this compression and encryption on stuff.
I know Donkey Kong Country was encrypted or something like that. One of those. I think it was hard to pirate or something.
Yeah, I mean, there were some interesting attempts to break piracy in the Super Famicom era. You know, diskette copiers were pretty common, especially in kind of like the periphery of Japan. Like, I had a friend in college from, I want to say, Singapore, and he borrowed Chrono Trigger from me one time. I was like, oh, yeah, sure, it's a cool game. And he brought it back the next day. I was like, you don't like it? You finished it? He was like, no, I copied it. I was like, you asked? I spent $90 on that game, you piece of garbage. So anyway, that was my introduction.
It's like a year's salary.
Yeah, seriously. I'm a college student. That was a lot of pennies
it's
for
me.
It's
ironic because I played through Chrono Trigger on Super Wildcard DX4. That was the first time I ever played it because I bought one for like $400 back in the like around 2000 or something, imported it from Japan. And I wanted to play it on an original system because it was hard to get the cartridge, you know. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm like, okay, sure, disc copiers. I just felt kind of ill used in that case. I was like, I spent a lot of money on that game.
Yeah,
and
I
he was
would
just
have
like,
been pissed
oh,
off.
Oh, yeah,
too.
By the way, I just pirated it. Thanks.
People have done that to me with CDs. I lend them a CD and they copy it. It's like, what are you doing? I don't know. It just bugs you, you know? It's like, I thought you were going to listen to it.
And yeah, like, I mean, if he had said, hey, can I copy this? I'd have been like, oh, sure. But I don't know. It felt kind of weird. Anyway,
I've got an update for you. Megumi Hayashibara
yes?
was in the Sailor Moon S movie.
There you go.
Which we have not covered on Sailor Business yet. But she was also Ranma in Ranma Half.
So. Yeah, she was female Ranma.
Yeah.
So specifically,
basically everything else other than Sailor
she
Moon.
She was the voice of hot-headed women in anime in the 90s.
Well, Sailor Mars already had a voice actress, I'm afraid. So
she was, wasn't that the voice actress who did Mega Man's voice? Oh, no, that was in the American version. No, no, I think, damn it, I'm all mixed up. In one of the Mega Man Legends games, his voice was provided by one of the Sailor Senshi, but I think that might have been in the U.S. version. I don't know. No, it was the Japanese version, I think. Damn it, I don't know. I'm all mixed up now. What have you done?
We are eventually going to talk about Castlevania.
Yeah, sure.
That's what I was promised when I signed up for this.
Yeah, so...
We've been through 4.5 episodes waiting to get to this point.
Oh, is that why you guys keep coming here? I see. Yeah. Anyway, so there's just a lot of information about Pop Full Mail. It's... because it was a Working Designs published game for Sega CD, it is very expensive now. You will never play this game legitimately. Ask a friend if you can borrow it and copy it on your diskette copier. It's fine.
I have a small story about that, which is there was a used game store where I bought all my NES games back in the 90s and used NES games. And in this glass counter, there were these special Sega CD games. Like Pop Full Mail was one of them, and it was like $100 or something. And the guy behind the counter had a beard, and he'd stroke it and say, "Yeah, man, that's like the greatest game of all time, but you can't have it because it's $100."
You know? Okay,
so I punched him. All right, I got arrested.
I feel like the story is not true.
A life of crime. Uh-huh. But it was.
So
like
you're saying this
premium.
Is a game for neckbeards? Is that what you're saying?
It was a premium item, somehow considered that way back then.
Yeah. No, it's I feel like all of the Sega CD stuff that Working Designs localized probably had really small print runs. They also had a tendency to put a lot of love and care into their packaging, you know, like glossy hollow foil type stuff. This benefited from that. But they went the full mile and they gave this like a total rewrite to play up the comedy element of it, which of course makes some people angry, but I think actually works really well in this specific game. So, yeah, if you ever have the chance to play Pop Full Mail, I recommend it, but it is kind of hard to come by in any form at this point. So it's the lost Metroidvania. I wish I still had my copy. So, two more games, and then you guys can stop sulking there. God, you guys are killing me.
Chris is still charging up.
He is. It's like a full episode. No, this is going to be, you know, 50 minutes. This is like DBZ style right here.
Everyone lend me your power.
Man, you're going to blow the moon out of its orbit. So something that I do expect you guys to talk about a little bit is the Gargoyles Quest series. I think we mentioned the original Gargoyles Quest in a previous episode.
The NES game?
No, the Game Boy game.
Game Boy game.
Okay. The sequel, Gargoyles Quest 2, was on NES and on Game Boy, but only in Japan. And then there was a Super NES sequel in 1995 called Demon's Crest, which plays a little bit differently than the others. It's not as platformy. It's more, I don't know, kind of hard for me to characterize it. I haven't played all the way through it because it kind of confuses me a little bit. But
I don't know. They all feel sort of like Mega Man and Castlevania mixed together or something.
Sort of. I mean, they're based on Ghosts and Goblins.
Ghosts and Goblins
is just like pure arcade shooting, and it's designed punishing. To be unfair. It's designed to make you hate life. Gargoyle's Quest adds an RPG system. It puts you in the role of the horrible red demon that kills you at the beginning of Ghosts and Goblins every time you play. You gain power as you go through the game. So by the end of the game, it's actually pretty easy because you've upgraded your attack, you've upgraded your health, you have the ability to fly further. But it is very like action RPG.
You grip onto things with your feet, like the side of pillars?
Yeah, you have the ability to, from the beginning, you can grab onto things. Okay. And that's actually how you sort of navigate. You jump onto walls and fly, and then you have to like kind of position yourself to travel from one pillar to another and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I remember the pillars. Yeah.
Now, here's my question, because I am only passingly familiar with these games. And honestly, I'm mostly familiar with them from Game Center CX in terms of the first one. Are they prequels to Ghosts and Goblins to explain why the Red Arimer is such an annoyance in those games?
I don't know that this is actually meant to be in continuity with Ghosts and Goblins. I think it's just like Tales from the Demon World. I really don't know. I guess you could sort of take it as a sort of prequel if you wanted to, because it does take place like thousands of years ago and you like fight Satan and stuff. I don't really know. I don't think you're supposed to think too hard about where it falls in the continuity. It's all pretty slippery.
Well, the reason I ask is because I think that's a really interesting way to take a game that is essentially made for the arcade format of being like punishingly hard and infamously having that ending where your reward for playing the game is to play through it again harder, but then turning it into a more enjoyable home gaming console experience by not continuing with that character, but spinning off something else from that franchise. And obviously you're not going to play as like Astaroth, but a minor villain who you're already familiar with his movement patterns and strengths. Is like it would be like if Mega Man 2 was about Gutsman, you know, like it's a very interesting way to go about it.
It's secretly about Gutsman. Mm.
All games are about Gutsman until proven otherwise.
These Gargoyle games, I was so excited when I first learned about them because I didn't know when they came out. I think I bought Gargoyle's Quest 2 on the NES used somewhere, and I was like, oh man, it's going to be awesome. I love these kind of games, but it's just too hard or something. And same with
They start out pretty tough.
Like the same with Demon's Crest. You know, I played it later, probably on emulator. I don't think I have the cartridge for it, but it's beautiful. It's like richly illustrated, but I just couldn't get into it, and I don't remember why. I think it was either hard to control or just difficult.
It's not that hard to control, but it is... that's the one that I haven't really played that much of. Like, I keep sliding off of it. I do own it on cartridge, and I have it on Virtual Console, which is definitely the way to get it, because the cartridge is now, like, $150 or something. It's stupid. But the Virtual Console version, you know, it's, like, $8. So definitely that's the way to play it. But, yeah, I haven't gotten that far into it. But I do like the first two games, especially the Game Boy game. I have a lot of really fond memories for. I've covered it on Game Boy Works. It's really interesting because it does put you in the role of this character that you encounter in Ghosts and Goblins. Everyone who's ever played that series knows, you know, the Red Arimer.
It's in the introduction.
Hates them. No, it's the introduction is a different character. It's a different demon. Okay. But it's the one that, you know, like you get past the opening stage and then there's that guy, like a little red demon sitting on the ground, and you come near it and he stands up, swoops into the air, swoops down and hits you. Oh, and you're dead. Yeah. Just like that. And he takes like 6 hits to attack, and he'll chase after you. Like if you try to sneak past him,
wow.
Like you can scroll the screen forward, but he's going to follow you and keep attacking you all through the stage. So he's this like crazy persistent bad guy.
It's and a then great
you
idea.
It puts you in his role, mm-hmm. and you start out and you're like, oh, I'm actually really weak. I can only take 2 hits, just like Arthur. Mm-hmm. But he does have the ability to jump and to glide for a few seconds or like 2 seconds. And he has a projectile. At the beginning, you can only shoot like halfway across the screen. We're talking the Game Boy screen, which is not a big screen to begin with.
Yeah.
And your jump is very low. Your hovering ability is very low. You're very weak, but you gain powers as you go. And eventually you gain different kinds of attacks. Like you have the ability to fire something. It's not very strong, but it's like a glob that sticks to spikes. And it allows you to use spiked walls as surfaces that you can jump off of. So there's like kind of this exploratory element to it. There's sort of a random RPG encounter element to it. There's a story element to it. It's a pretty ambitious game. I mean, it was one of the first Game Boy games that came along and you were like, wow, this is something I haven't really experienced on a console. It's pretty interesting. And then, you know, the NES sequel just builds on that and has, you know,
color.
More to it. Yeah, it's color. You have more space to maneuver because it's, you know, bigger pixel resolution. And then the Super NES version is, it changes things up a lot. Like you have the ability to fly infinitely, like hover infinitely from the beginning. Huh. And you, instead of, you know, upgrading your powers so much, what you do is you gain the ability to transform into other elementals. So you can like become a stone gargoyle that, I think, you know, has like strong physical power, but can't fly very high. And I can't remember what other kinds of gargoyles there are, but you have different elemental forms that you can change into. So maneuvering through the world kind of becomes a puzzle, like to figure out which element should I be using here? Like which form should I be using? And, you know, figuring out which powers are best in a certain situation against a given boss and so on and so forth.
Now, is he a gargoyle, in the American version because of Nintendo's notorious, not being down with the devil?
Yeah, although they could have just called it by its Japanese title, which was Red Armor, but instead they called it Gargoyle's Quest.
I mean, Gargoyle's Quest is a better name because
they changed him on the box art from red to green. So like the most I guess iconic element of the character, the fact that he is the red devil who torments you in Ghosts and Goblins, is lost on the box art. But you know, once you start playing, even if you have even a passing familiarity with Ghosts and Goblins, you'll be like, wait a minute, I know this guy. He's not green.
A demon.
And you know, in the subsequent games, I can't remember if he's green on the NES game cover art. I think he is. No, actually, I think they changed him back to red. And then for the Super NES game, at that point, you know, Mortal Kombat was out. They were like, whatever. It's Demon's off. Crest. Yeah. He's a pawn of Satan. You're evil. It's fine. Whatever. How things changed.
Just as long as there are no crucifixes in the game.
Exactly.
I do like the idea of video game sequels just having titles that rhyme with their previous incarnations.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you were
Demon's Crest.
Like if Super Mario Brothers 2 was like Super Mario Mothers.
It's just, it makes it easier for rappers to drop it in a song.
Super Mario Others? Because there are other characters? That could be a good one.
Are you othering Mario? So one last game, and it's actually not a full game, is a portion of a game, and that is The Great Cave Offensive from Kirby Superstar. Do you guys know this?
Yeah, I played it.
Okay. I'm familiar with Kirby Superstar, but I never recognized this as a Metroidvania.
Yeah,
it's
me neither.
It's kind of Metroidvania-ish. It is an open-ended platformer in which you are basically traveling around trying to acquire treasure, and there's a puzzle element to it because different treasures are placed in a way that you have to use certain powers that you, of course, copy from enemies to prevent them from being lost forever. So like a perfect playthrough of the game requires you to know the layout really well and know which powers you can acquire from where. It's definitely an edge case. It is not a full, like, you know, start to finish Metroidvania game, but it has a large map to explore. Lots of things that have to be cleared with specific powers. It has the ability to save your progress and so on and so forth. So it's an interesting take on this kind of style of game. And the Kirby games would actually go all in on exploratory platforming with Kirby and the Amazing Mirror for Game Boy Advance. I don't know if you ever played that.
Yeah.
That one was really interesting.
Somehow I didn't feel like that was this kind of game either.
Are you kidding? It's like
through the whole thing.
Totally open-ended.
Well, I guess there are doors backtracking. Everywhere. Doors and backtracking.
Like, yeah. Everything is all interconnected.
But do you power up over time?
Well, it's Kirby, so there is that limitation. Like, you power up based on what you acquire from enemies. Mm-hmm. But a lot of things, you have to acquire a power-up in one place and then go to another place and use it to access that area. And it's also a multiplayer game. Like, it's four people can play Kirby together with link cables, which I have never done. Yeah, I would love to do.
Like fun.
You know, it does involve the link cable thing, which sucks. But I would love to see this game revisited on Switch, maybe.
Yeah, that would be great.
With multiplayer through wireless or even over the internet.
Yeah.
Because it's an interesting game, and with a little more refinement and a little less link cable, it would be, I think, pretty great.
Yeah, just about anything on Switch. Switch is like we've been waiting for that our whole lives, the eventual evolution of consoles.
Wow. That's,
I don't think you're wrong.
That's really saying a lot.
Excuse me, sorry.
That's really saying a lot. I don't disagree, though.
Nintendo paid me to
say that. It's really hard for me to play any other system at this point. Like, I have to sit in front of a TV all the time to play PS4 games.
Yeah, I have not touched my PS4 in 6 months.
Yeah, I just reviewed Lost Sphere, and they only sent out PS4 codes, even though the game is also on Switch, and it killed me! Because I had to capture footage for it for IGN, but I didn't have to capture footage for the whole game. And when I wasn't capturing footage, I was like, I just want to go, like, sit next to my wife on the couch while she's watching TV and work on this game. But instead, I have to go down to my office and sit by myself while, you know, like...
Yeah. If you need that to do that obligatory spousal physical nearness kind of thing, play a game at the same time.
It's not even obligatory for some of us.
It's obligatory for me. But that's why Switch is so great. Plus, if you have kids and they're using the TV to watch, you know, Sesame Street or something.
Right.
And you want to play something violent and gory.
My opiate is Switch games.
That's great.
Anyway, that's kind of a side tangent.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, superstar on a... Uh-oh.
He's charging up again.
Sorry, I'm just rubbing my hands.
Superstar is just a sideshow compared to the main event.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, watch us get there and we'll be like, I have nothing to say about Castlevania because we have talked about it so much.
We have talked about this so much that I think before we get into this, it's time to do the letters.
Sounds good.
You were such a grown-up about
that.
Get
it all out of the way.
All right, so Nancy Pelosi, stop emailing me. let's see. So there are actually two parts to this mailbag. The first is Symphony of the Night, and the second is the discussion for the back end of this podcast, which is what happened to the Metroidvania genre in the late 90s. So we'll read those first. Why not? So the question is, what did happen? Like I said, you know, between 97 and 2002, there were like five of these games that came out anywhere in the world. It was ridiculous. I mean, and most of them were actually the Metroidvania games, the Castlevania games.
Yeah.
And then there was like also Tomba and Shantae. That was like it.
Yeah.
It was a dark time. Life sucked.
I have a theory on this that I think probably a lot of people share. First-person shooters happened. Which they've been around for a while, but I think console first-person shooters became a much bigger thing post-Metroidvania, post-PlayStation era. And
people were like, Tenka? Yeah, hell yeah. I don't need no Metroid. Well, I got Tenka.
No one wanted sprites anymore.
I got Power Slave.
Everybody wanted polygonal 3D graphics. And you see it even in fighting games, like, you know, Virtua Fighter. Which looks like trash compared to those beautiful sprites of Street Fighter.
Virtua Fighter holds up pretty well.
Yes, but in terms of look, like that was where things were going. Like things were going towards Dead or Alive, towards the 3D fighter. Sprites fell out of fashion. No one wanted to work with them because they looked old.
And yeah, I don't think that was the FPS doing that. Yeah. I think that was just a larger trend.
Well, the first-person shooter, the 3D action game, I've mentioned this before on the show, like I literally can't play them. Like I can't play for Overwatch is the first person shooter I've ever been able to sit there and play because I get sick. I have motion sickness. Sprites, fine. I am super good with side-scrolling platformers. But they looked old-fashioned because they looked like what essentially games had looked like since the early 80s. But they weren't old enough to have nostalgia yet. So when you start seeing more and more Metroidvanias, and you start seeing the term Metroidvania and the explosion of new Metroidvanias, stuff like Guacamelee or Zeo Drifter or Blaster Master Zero, which just came out, they are often done as nostalgia projects. In Blaster Master Zero's case, like very literally, they come back in a way that they were just what Castlevania games were at the time. And even Castlevania tried to move away from it, but couldn't because those games were also trash.
Yeah, this genre really sort of lost steam in the 90s. I mean, trying to get you guys to talk about 90s Metroidvania games that aren't Super Metroid and Castlevania Symphony of the Night has been like pulling teeth. Like, you guys don't care.
No one cares.
These are good games we're talking about, but you're like,
Well, I think it's because you have quite literally the two best versions of this kind of game in a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah, that was just 3 years apart.
No, I've given you a couple answers to this. We've talked about this before on one of the last 5 or 10 episodes we've done about Metroidvanias. One of the things we talked about was the rise of 3D platformers like Mario 64 and Zelda Ocarina of Time, like taking the lion's share of the technical, you know, pushing the limits of graphics and all that stuff, and that 2D games were passe. And PlayStation, I think the Sony actually didn't want companies developing 2D games for their console for a little while or something. They actively downplayed it. And the other thing I always say, which is semantically, that, you know, Metroidvanias weren't invented until Symphony of the Night. So how can you be, you know, how could you even be missing
the style of game? Like, yeah, if you don't want to be pedantic about it, like
action RPGs,
the action platformer.
Yeah. There action platformer RPG elements. I swear there has to be some kind of leveling up aspect to it. To me,
it's the only thing that keeps Mario World out of there.
Yeah, well, so, well, you know, Mario World, it's not nonlinear. It's not.
It kind of is.
Anyway, but I know, you know, what Jeremy's saying, which is,
and you affect permanent changes with the Switch palaces. I see where Chris changes is coming from. I don't agree, but I see
routes, nonlinear routes.
In some way, every game is like a Metroidvania then. Like, no, super strong.
Go on, tell me about Tetris and its Metroidvania elements.
Well, Tetris,
permanent change the environment.
Your skill is built up in your own head, so it's like an external Metroidvania instead of kept track of in the game.
In a way, aren't we all the president of the United States? I mean, we're all on Twitter. Tetris, we all say stupid stuff on
Tetris
Twitter.
Tetris is a reverse Metroidvania where you're the bad guy and the game is leveling up as it continues and keeps attacking you.
All right, you win.
But I think Jeremy's premise about the rise of the 3D game, which I think we've mentioned before, is the reason why there weren't so many of these 2D action platformers during that period of time.
I didn't realize that I'd actually said that in a previous episode. That's been in my head for a long time, but I forget what actually like is in my brain and what actually comes out of my mouth.
The thing is, you do 1,000 episodes of Retronauts a month, so I can't imagine you remembering which thing you said on which podcast.
But it's not time for cheers. It's time for vengeance. Oh, I was talking out loud again.
I think that's why you saw the Metroidvania thriving on the Game Boy Advance, on the DS, on the 3DS even. Because the portable systems, you could get away with a game that looked old, that had sprites.
Yeah, 2D.
Whereas no one wanted to sit down and play a sprite-based game on the PlayStation 2.
I did.
I did too, yeah, believe
the
me.
The game I looked forward to most at the PlayStation 2 launch was Gradius 3 and 4. It turned out not to be that good, but it was
you
what
excited
me.
You were the exception
in
the American audience.
Never.
The thing I love the Game Boy Advance when it came out because I was so excited that there would be more Super Nintendo style games for that, and that there would be ports there.
Or they like Super Nintendo, but better stuff like Wario Land Advance.
F-Zero, new F-Zero games were really cool on there. I loved that, and you know, Yeah, like Super NES games with more colors and better sound, you know.
But the selling point of a console, the selling point of hardware, whether it's PC, whether it's console, has always been graphics. Right. And well, the way that you show off graphics,
I think that's a big part of why we all love the Switch so much, because it's not about the graphics, and it's become this natural home for indie games that often have a very sort of dated look to them, but they're still a lot of fun. And for some reason, having it on that little screen, like, it's just as natural as when those games showed up on Vita. But this is also a console you can play on your TV, and all of a sudden everything all kind of comes together. That's a huge part of the system's appeal for me.
Also, I think people were very willing, because Symphony of the Night was so good, to let that be the tombstone on the genre.
The tombstone actually, like, jumps and attacks you.
Yeah. Up the tombstone, which in Japan is a cross, but in America it's just a stick. I will say,
Symphony of the Night was not extremely popular when it first came out in America, because among my friends, I was the only one who bought it when it was released. And then several years later, when the Egavanias were popular on the Game Boy, I had a friend who was really into them, and he was surprised that I had the original Symphony of the Night. He's like, whoa, you have the original copy. Like, it was some kind of crazy rare thing. So
It was a greatest hits game. So
yeah, I got it with that. Was it ugly actually?
I don't know if it
bar.
Was rare, but it was.
It was just highly coveted.
It was overshadowed by so many other games at the time, and like especially if you were on Nintendo platforms or something, you know.
Yeah, there was no. You were not going to get a sprite based action platformer on the 64.
Yeah,
you know, you were going to get.
I mean, there was Mischief Makers.
I wish there were.
I don't know what that is.
What? Shake, shake. Shake, shake. Okay, you missed out.
No idea.
It's a treasure game by the same people who made Pokemon.
Speaking of Popple Mail?
I do, but first let me before we go to the mailbag, I want to put out my theory on the death of the Metroidvania, which is kind of related to what you guys said, you know, because of the rise of polygons. But I don't think it's necessarily so much that, you know, sprites became unfashionable. I mean, there is that element, but people were still making 2D games. The thing is, though, that the Metroidvania exploratory platformer, side-scrolling, you know, 2D platformer, always existed kind of as a companion to the top-down Zelda-style action RPG. Like, those two games are cut from the same cloth. I mean, Igarashi has even said that Symphony of the Night, like, he drew just as much from Zelda as from Metroid for that. So you have these two basically different perspectives on the same game. Now you put everything in polygons, and all of a sudden, those things become one and the same. There no longer needs to be a barrier between the side view and the top-down view. You look at Ocarina of Time, and the game that it's most heavily influenced by is clearly A Link to the Past, but there's almost as much Zelda 2 in that game with the sword combat and the minimalistic platforming as there is Link to the Past. So you have games like, if you want to say Tomb Raider, sure, or Soul Reaver, or Fade to Black. All of a sudden, these games are kind of top-down, kind of behind the shoulder, kind of side-scrolling. Like, they manage to encompass all those views depending on basically how you put the camera. So I feel like people were really excited by the prospect of no longer being constrained by technology to just one viewpoint, to have the ability to shift the camera around and to, you know, give you a different scenario and a different setup at a different angle, depending on what was best for the current situation. I mean, you look at Ocarina of Time, there are some parts where you need to kind of play it in first person mode, but there are other parts that you kind of have to approach as a platformer, and some parts that you approach more as traditional Zelda. So it all changes up, you know, sort of dynamically depending on what the game needs to be. And, you know, you see this in the first person shooter with games like Tribes and Halo, where you can be like a guy running around the ground, or all of a sudden you can jump into a vehicle and it becomes a third person vehicular shooter. So it's just that opportunity that suddenly technology afforded everyone. I really don't think it was necessarily people were like, oh, sprites are stupid and bad, so much as like, wow, look what you can do with polygons. Like, our games can be more robust. They can be more dynamic. They can be more varied. And we can really express all these ideas that we've had and have had to sort of winnow out into one form or another. Like, these can all exist together in the same space. That's great. And if you look at the one last game that I wanted to include in this, kind of as a corollary, that is a PlayStation game, pretty obscure, called The Divide, Enemies Within. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this game.
Nope.
It was launched at the beginning of 1996. So just kind of slid right past everyone. It was very shortly after the PlayStation launch in the US. And it's kind of a Blaster Master-ish game. It's kind of a 3D platformer, but it also has kind of like a pulled back top-down arena view. So it's like a shooter, a platformer. It's exploratory. You're powering up your little robot guy. It's like a whole lot of things all at once, somewhere between Jumping Flash and Tomb Raider and Metroid and Blaster Master. And you look at this game and it's really clunky and rough. It has those shaky graphics in the way that PS1 games do. And it's, you know, before the dual analog controls. Mm-hmm. So everything is, you know, digital controls, and it's very clumsy to move around in 3D space. But you look at it and you're like, they were onto something here, and they saw where this genre could go beyond just a side-scrolling platformer or a top-down adventure shooter or whatever. And they were trying to do that, and I don't think they quite did it, but they were trying, and that's where video games were about to go.
Yeah.
So, sorry, I've been talking a long time.
It's okay. We're still charging.
I guess I'm impassioned, huh?
All right. How did you learn about that game, by the way? I've never...
It was on Hardcore Gaming 101 a long time ago, okay. And so I checked it out and was like, huh, this is kind of rough, but I like it. All right, so yes, we do have letters. We get letters and written letters in the mail. We're going to read them to you now. So, letters about the death of Metroidvania. Uh-oh, Benj is already falling asleep.
Yeah.
No whiskey for you, just coffee. I'm going to pour it down your throat. From Matt Bolenbach. Why no Metroidvania? In a word, 3D. Everyone was enamored with fancy pants polygons. Blocky 3D was the new hotness, whereas gorgeous pixel art was old and busted. No company wanted to devote resources to a game that was 2D, a game which could, even if correctly, incorrectly be viewed as stuck in the past. It took the GBA to breathe life into the genre, as I would assume development costs were less and expectations were lower. Oh, it looks pretty good for a handheld. Can you imagine a Metroidvania on the N64? Oh, what could have been? Maybe devs were convinced that Symphony of the Night was the pinnacle of the genre as well, although I think that holds less water, as in video games, the masterpieces are imitated soon and often after their release. Wow, he's like, this is like a summary of everything we've just talked about.
Got it done a lot faster than I did, too. Sure, so good job on that.
But there's more from Zach Stewart. Let's see. I think the reason we saw a drop in Metroidvania was the greater focus on 3D platformers. Even though Symphony of the Night was released after Mario 64, it showed that the industry was pushing full steam into 3D. Developers clamored to make and master 3D platforming games, and some 2D Castlevania games seemed archaic. With that said, we ended up getting some great 3D platformers like Banjo-Kazooie and DK64, showing that the genre was working, even though Bubsy 3D tried to bring the genre down. Personally, these 3D collectathons ended up filling the hole left by no Metroidvanias. I don't know if I agree with all of these controversial opinions, but okay.
Yeah.
What do you guys think? Did DK64 make you think, you know, I don't need another Metroidvania game?
No, nothing has ever made me think that.
That game was too much collecting. It.
No, look, there's red bananas and green bananas and blue bananas. Yeah. Like, what more do you need in life to be fulfilled?
Purple bananas?
Oh, damn it. From Ian Dirk. In thinking about your question regarding the lack of Metroidvanias between 97 and 2002, I'd say the emergence of the first-person shooter as a dominant form of 3D games. Moves to 3D games had been going on before Symphony of the Night, and plenty of early games were exploration-based. However, PC gaming built on a lot of shooters during this time period. Games like Counter-Strike, Quake Arena, and Unreal Tournament came out during this time. Games that were more upgrade-based, like System Shock 2 and Deus Ex, captured parts of the Metroidvania experience with shooter mechanics in place of platforming. It's also worth noting that the new player coming to the console market, Microsoft, counted on the growth of console shooters. 3D is part of the issue, and the challenges of 3D platforming were always going to prevent good exploration games in the early days of polygons. With shooters as an easy and profitable alternative, I'd guess that shooters crowded the market.
I fully agree with that. And again, as previously said, and I think it's telling that we didn't get a 3D game that genuinely had the Metroidvania feel until Arkham Asylum. Like, Arkham Asylum is kind of the best application of the game that's, because, you know, the Metroidvanias are based entirely on movement in a way that I find very appealing. And that's much more difficult to pull off in a 3D environment than it is in a 2D environment, even if you're making steps to make the 2D environment make sense, like Symphony of the Night does.
I would argue that Soul Reaver came pretty close to getting all of those things. No?
Okay.
Yeah, there's another game. What was that? That PS1 game, like...
Tomb Raider.
Grim something. What was that?
Grim Fandango.
Not Grim Fandango. It was the guy with the skull head. His simple word.
Skull Monkeys?
Skull, no.
No, that was a platformer. That was a 2D platformer, but that wasn't exploratory. It was claymation.
I don't remember what it's called, but there's a neat 3D action.
Skullhead.
Just pause it while I look at it.
There's no pausing in this life, but
well, to talk about Legacy of Kain, Soul Reaver, I feel
what
like
you reaving.
I feel like that. What's that?
You're reaving souls?
Yeah, Soul Reaver. Soul Reaver, the Legacy of Kain, with a K.
Yes.
I feel like medieval.
Medieval with the skull guy. Yeah.
I don't know. Action adventure hack and slash.
I feel like Soul Reaver falls much more into the Tomb Raider mold of being more puzzle based in a lot of ways, especially in terms of Soul Reaver.
Yeah, it is. But there's also an upgrade element to it, a pretty significant upgrade element to it that increases your mobility in the way that Tomb Raider never had.
That's true. Well, it does have that.
Tomb Raider never had that until Rise of the Tomb Raider, at which point you have these like open world hubs where everything becomes kind of Metroidvania-ish in 3D. I don't know.
But Rise of the Tomb Raider is also post-Arkham Asylum.
True. So that's true. Everything is different now.
It changed everything.
Also isometric action RPGs like Diablo became really popular. And they just weren't platformers, but they were action-oriented RPGs. That's sort of a sister genre to the Metroidvania.
It is,
in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Although, in a different sense, because Diablo uses so much random generation, it's not iterative instanced gaming design. Mm-hmm. So a different kind of spirit there. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, there is this drive to constantly upgrade your power and take on bigger threats and dive deeper into the dungeon.
Shuffle equipment and you're leveling up.
Yep. From Matthew Groves, the late 90s to early 2000s was a huge shift from 2D gaming to 3D gaming, however often misguided. Let's start with an assertion that is that 3D games were an easier sell during that period and 2D was being seen as dated. So let's rephrase the question you're asking is, why weren't there more 3D Metroidvania games during this period? Is it possible that a 3D Metroidvania is too cost prohibitive? A huge interconnected map can take a lot of effort to design and implement in 3D, especially in the somewhat primitive 3D game environments that were possible at the turn of the millennium. And that's why I love Mega Man Legends, because by the end of that game, Catalox Island is just one huge interconnected place where you can go anywhere from any entrance point into the underground. I don't know if you guys have played that recently, but it's so good.
Nope.
Grand Theft Auto 3, for instance, came out during this period. It seemed incredibly huge and immersive, but I think that's more a trick of design than it is of actual complexity in the world. Furthermore, perhaps the memory requirements of such a world were just too much for game systems at the time. A Metroid-style game with severe memory constraints is a game experience that's 50% loading screens.
That's true. And I remember, like, I distinctly remember it being such a big deal when, what was it? Was it San Andreas didn't have loading screens? Like, Vice City still did. But there were, you know, all in GTA 3, there were all the loading screens between islands. And San Andreas was like, no load screens.
You can drive
such a
from
huge deal.
Las Vegas to San Francisco and never have to load.
Yeah, to get that yay.
From John Afta, I feel there wasn't really much of a life with the Metroidvania games. Yes, there were some games like Blaster Master and Wonder Boy, but overall there wasn't really that much. As you guys were having multiple discussions on the timeline of Metroidvanias, you were mostly throwing in games that had elements of them, but hardly any were full Metroidvania-like games. Oh, Benj, you got this.
He's a friend of mine. What's his name again? Who was that?
All right. Let's see.
Edward Benjamins.
Whoa, here's a huge one. I can't winnow this down. So sorry, Shane Killian. Thank you for writing so much, but that was too much. All right. I'll read one more of these and then we'll take a break. From Ronin Chaos. Wow, that's a hardcore name.
Yeah.
I think there are two specific reasons these games disappeared. The first is, I have to imagine, designing one of these isn't exactly straightforward. I imagine it takes a lot of pre-planning in regards to level design and how you actually path the player through these things. I also think there's a language to this kind of game that relies on different visual and aural cues, which were replaced with tutorials in 3D gaming. Due to this, it's not a stretch to think that most developers would rather put their resources into designing a 3D game and 3D space that would net them more money. New technology always makes people go a little crazy. And getting back to something Chris has said, the second reason is that no Metroidvania has ever made traversal look as fun to look at. Has ever made traversal as fun to look at as Symphony of the Night. The animation is stellar for everything Alucard does. Play the game and tell me that a 2D game out there has a more fun set of animations than dropping off of a cliff as Alucard and watching his shadows trail behind him. Same with making his cape flare around when you just turn from left to right, or right to left. Symphony of the Night made traversal look interesting, and it was really nice to watch. And if you don't believe me, just try it. Jump off a high cliff with Alucard and land four screens down below where you just jumped, or shuffle around from side to side. It's way more fun than you think. So it's all about shadows.
Yeah, I've spent hours doing that, just jumping around.
I mean, I think
he does have a neat animation where he lands and he recovers from.
Yeah, there's some solidity to it. Like you kind of feel gravity on those old vampire bones.
He does the superhero landing and then he stands up and throws his cape back. It's the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah, like it's just, you know, the ground cracking away from being Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, those are some thoughts on the death of the Metroidvania genre. And when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the game that killed the genre with its awesomeness, because you guys have to, my God, Chris is like, he's actually doing like Vegeta here. He is about to release like the craziest Kamehameha, and wow, his hair just spiked up. It's turning yellow. I don't know what's happening. I think we need to get out of here.
Yeah.
And here we are, finally, at long last, talking about the only game these two men care about, Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
It's pretty true.
I'm just going to sit back and let you guys talk. So Castlevania Symphony of the Night, 1997, debuted like May-ish or so.
Never played it.
Japan.
It's a very good impression.
Get the hell out. Launched here, I think, in October of 97.
97.
Great movie. Great movie. I'm all mixed up now. Great game.
Fear has a new address.
Is it 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
I just remember that was the text of the Symphony of the Night ads.
Yeah, I have a scan of that on my blog. The first Symphony of the Night ad, vintagecomputing.com. Mm-hmm. If you want to see it.
Yes, you should check it out, mm-hmm. everyone. But yes, the follow-up to Castlevania Rondo of Blood, which at that point had not actually shipped in the U.S., mm-hmm. which is why the prologue says Bloodlines, the Sega Genesis game that has nothing whatsoever to do with Symphony of the Night. But they were like, well, it's two games that have blood in the name. Okay, sure enough. But this one basically threw out all the rules and said, let's just do Castlevania the way we want. There's no whip. I'm a dude with a sword. I'm also a vampire.
You're not a Belmont.
You know, you get to play as a Belmont for like 2 minutes.
David Bowie would make a good Alucard. You know,
he would. Yes, well, he would have.
Would have. Yeah.
Castlevania Symphony of the Night is arguably the single best video game of all time. And I don't think that's news.
I agree with that.
Yeah, but I do like it is, if not the best game of all time, certainly the best of its generation, and certainly the best side-scrolling platformer of all time.
There are definitely people who get really angry when you say things like that.
They can get angry, and I'll just be over here being right.
Castlevania Symphony of the Night is really bad, and here's why. I wrote a piece for actually a multi-part series for US Gamer last year.
I remember that. It's a good series.
Thank you. Talking about all the great things that Symphony of the Night did, and some dude got on NeoGAF and was like, Jeremy Parrish always says stupid crap like this. He's so dumb. This game is garbage. People who like it are trash. Everyone is trash. Nothing about this game is good. I hate you all.
That was me, by the way.
Well, when that child turns 17, perhaps
they would like to say a point about that, which is that when someone says this game is the greatest game of all time, we're actually just saying this is what I think is the greatest game of all time. There's a subtext
seriously?
Yeah.
Oh my God. This changes everything.
It's an opinion. Yeah.
What?
So it's
but
okay.
Regardless of my hyperbole, Symphony of the Night is a masterpiece on every level. It's beautiful. It's beautiful in a way that it's still beautiful 21 years later. It
21.
Plays, yeah.
It can drive.
Yeah.
It can vote.
It can vote.
It'll be able to get car insurance.
The controls are still incredible. They're tight. They're intuitive.
Reconfigurable too.
Yeah. And they're reconfigurable.
I love that.
But the default left hand, right hand mechanic
that's
brilliant.
So unique. Yeah. Like no other game does that. And it really, like, you don't even kind of think about it that much because most of the time, I think most people like put a sword in one hand and a shield in the other, but you don't have to do that. And in fact, that's how you use a lot of consumables. You put them in like your offhand
so that you can
toss peanuts into the air and try to catch them.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's such a brilliant and honestly immersive idea to, if you want to use a consumable, you have to essentially reach into your pocket and pull it out, right? Like you have to go into your inventory and equip it to
your hand. Where did I put that custard pie? Oh yes, my back pocket.
The bosses.
Sound like him too.
The bosses are incredible. Like, to the last one are incredible and amazing designs. Like from Slogra and Gaibon on up
from Castlevania 4.
Yeah. But like on up to there's a great Dracula fight in that a lot of Castlevania games and even the Egovania games kind of stumble on having like a really great Dracula fight. The Succubus is great.
I don't know. The Dracula fight's kind of underwhelming because by that point you're so powerful and he's like sitting back there on his weird throne with hands. And it's weird how he like sometimes generates succubi and stuff and then squishes them. I'm like, what are you doing, Dracula?
Oh, I love that. I love that because he's feeding on their blood.
Oh, is that what he's doing?
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, he gets health back from that. Everything in that game makes sense.
I killed
him
so fast I didn't realize that.
Well, yeah, because I'm sure you got
use a shield rod, Jeremy.
Absolutely. But the question is, what do you use the shield rod with?
The shield?
Which shield, though? Every shield gives you a different
shield.
Is it the Alucard shield that does the thing?
The Alucard shield does jack squat.
Okay.
Because it's a fake. But the Alucard shield, what does that do?
Alucard shield.
It does a ton of damage and heals you when it does damage.
Okay.
Yeah, it's essentially invincible. You charge it up and you hit people for 256 nonstop, and you can walk through them, but whatever.
And hits almost as fast as the Chrysagrum. Like, it's very
the
much the Chrysagrum.
The Chrysagrum?
What do you call it?
I called it Chrysagrum, but close enough.
I call it
in there.
I don't know how you pronounce that thing, so good enough.
Yeah.
But that's the crazy sword that is the rare drop from the thing in the long library.
You could finish that game and never know about.
I don't know about it. What does it look like?
It's just like a sword, but you don't actually see the blade when you attack with it. You get like these three swipes really fast that all hit for full damage.
And it doesn't look like it. Like it doesn't, when you equip it in the inventory screen, it doesn't look like it's a good sword because it does like 30 points of damage less than everything else you've got at that point. But it also hits five times.
Right.
Yeah.
With every hit.
Yes. And on top of that, there's no like recovery downtime from
it. And
you
can do it in motion. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to stop. It's not like a broadsword where you have to like stop and go. Hurr!
Yeah,
which is like the ultimate expression of what you've been working towards in that game, which is mobility, which is unstoppable fast movement.
Attack while maintaining momentum.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I think one of the most brilliant things about it, a couple things that I want to get through, because I've been waiting so long.
Maybe first we should talk about what this game is. Like, how does it fit into this discussion we've been having of Metroidvania? Like,
it's the Metroidvania.
Sure, probably people know what it is, but I feel like, you know, for the sake of completeness, we should give some context.
Nonlinear platforming Castlevania action RPG.
It is, and it even gives an in-continuity reason for the castle to be as big as it is, as complex as it is, and to require you to double back, which is the castle itself is a creature of chaos. But yeah, you are Alucard. You have risen from your sleep.
Alucard is...
Adrian Fahrenheit Tepish.
Who is...
The son of Dracula.
Right,
Dracula.
There you go.
The half-human son of Dracula. He's a Dompier.
Who is his mother? I don't remember.
His Lisa. Mother is a witch burned at the stake.
Okay.
Which is a great narrative moment in that game, but I think like you can hear how excited I'm getting talking
you
about
are.
It.
Yeah, so you play as Alucard, who could previously have been a companion in Castlevania 3. And he was actually the crappiest companion. He fired fireballs. He threw fireballs, and he could turn into a bat. But the only reason you really needed to be Alucard is if you took the route where you have to like climb this the shaft of falling blocks. Like the blocks can kill you if you stand under them, and they're random, and you don't know where they're going to fall, but you have to use them as a staircase. It's not very fun. And so you can turn into a bat and just fly past all that. But otherwise, he kind of sucked in that game. But in this game, he took a nap for 500 years, and holy cow, it did wonders for him. What a great beauty sleep.
He is, I think, narratively, if you look at all the characters in Castlevania up to that point, the Belmonts are very interesting. But you have the son of Dracula in there, and there's no easier plot to make great then the good guy goes bad and the son of the original bad guy has to come back to stop him. It's a perfect narrative for this game because the trick of Castlevania, Symphony of the Night, is that the final boss, allegedly, is Richter Belmont. So
who was the hero of Rondo of Blood.
The hero of Rondo of Blood.
Who you play as in the prologue to this game.
Yes. So it turns the established order of the game around in that you're essentially a Dracula going through a castle to fight a Belmont instead of the other way around. And he's got the whip. He's got the holy powers. You've got all the Dracula stuff. Like from the start of the game, you can do the teleport fireball. If you have your magic boosted high enough, like you can do.
Yeah. If you know, Dracula if you stuff. Know how to do it, you can do that. You can, do the blood, the soul steal. You can do the
soul steal.
Yep.
Dark metamorphosis.
That's the one. Dark metamorphosis.
Yeah.
Yes. Love that stuff.
So yeah, that's there's all controller these, combination.
Right. Controller combinations that things. You have to discover. Like you can buy them from the shop or from the shopkeeper. But if you know them at the beginning, you don't have to buy them. You can just use them.
Yeah. And a lot of times you can't do them often or well because your magic's sad at the start of the game. You don't have the MP. But you do the Dracula stuff throughout the game. And it is a game built around doing Dracula stuff.
Right. Like your primary the ability to like go places, to unlock new areas, mostly revolves not around equipment, but around unlocking Alucard's vampiric potential to turn into mist, to turn into a bat. You can turn into a wolf just to kind of get the Bram Stoker trilogy in there, but that's not really important. But you also have to overcome your vampiric limitations. You can't go into water without taking damage. Like Dracula in the novel, you can't cross running water until you acquire a holy symbol that protects you from the power of the water, from the damage of the water. So on one hand, you're like trying to become the best vampire ever, but on the other, you're like trying to overcome the fact that, oh yes, I'm a vampire, so that I have these weaknesses and limitations.
Well done. Like it fits with the, it is the game that does the best job of blending Bram Stoker Dracula mythology with Castlevania Dracula mythology, which is a very vastly different thing.
Yes, it is.
Because if you remember from 14 episodes ago, the original premise of Castlevania isn't necessarily that you're fighting Dracula. It's that you're fighting all the movie monsters.
Right. You know? It was basically they did Universal's Dark Universe.
Yeah.
You know, 30 years before Universal.
Plus Medusa, because she was in Clash of the Titans.
True, true.
So the idea of blending what started there with a textual justification for Dracula to be the boss of all these guys, which is that he's Satan. They give you then the good Dracula who has to balance out all these weaknesses and limitations in a way that's really compelling in terms of gameplay and also really compelling narratively, which is a super difficult thing for those games to balance. And none of them, and I say this as someone who loves every Egovania game, none of them have done it as well, especially when they've gone back to more Bram Stoker stuff, like the Morrison Harker right. stuff. The where they do it really well is when they went further into Castlevania mythology with Soma re-embodying Dracula by taking mastery of all the monsters, which is, again, a very brilliant narrative and gameplay overlap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in terms of play mechanics, in terms of like how the game expresses all of this, one, it takes the sort of interlinked multi-path design of Rondo of Blood, where you could, you know, find secret routes and battle alternate demons and things like that. There were, you know, characters to unlock and to rescue, and you could play as Maria if you managed to find her. It takes that and says, okay, but what if we had all these branching paths, and then at the end of a stage, you weren't forced to go to the next stage, but could go back. And basically it says, what if we turn this castle into, you know, a series of stages, but there's no forced forward progression. And at times you have to go back and you have to find these routes. And it also expresses Alucard being different than a Belmont by giving him an inventory, by giving him magic points, by, you know, he still has the ability to use sub-weapons and collect hearts for those to augment his special attacks. But he doesn't use a whip. He uses short swords, rapiers, zweihanders. He uses, he has cestus knuckles. He has, like, blunt clubs and staves. And just, like, everything that's not a whip is available to Alucard. So it really differentiates him, and all these different play styles emerge from the different mechanics and properties these weapons have. Like a two-handed sword or a claymore or something is going to make you stop and wind up and take a huge swing, and it's going to have like a huge range, and you're going to hit really hard, but you know, you have downtime when you do that. But on the other hand, you could equip brass knuckles or something, and they're going to allow you to like walk and punch and run and punch and not slow down. But, you know, mitigating that momentum is the fact that you may not kill everything in one hit. So if you're not careful, you'll punch and then walk right into it and take damage. So you have to think about like, how do I load out Alucard? You have shields, but you don't have to use those. It's good against things that fire projectiles, but maybe, you know, you just would rather evade. You'd rather use your backstep, or you'd rather use a double jump to get over things. So instead of using a shield, you put a different kind of weapon on your second hand. So you can alternate, like, you know, do quick punches and then finish something off with a sword or something along those lines. So there's just a ton of variety in terms of how you can play. And it really makes a different game experience than classic Castlevania.
Yeah, the way I always played was I would assign the shield hand to one of the trigger buttons at the top, or the shoulder buttons on the PS1 controller. And you can just hold that down the whole time and hit your other hand, and it will alternate automatically. You can hit, and then your shield will come right back up. It's so awesome. And it's just, you don't even have to push it again, you know. So I just run around, hold that down. And then you can, you know, block fireballs, block attacks, and then hit. And so there is that strategy that's a lot like Zelda 2 in a way, ancestrally.
It also has an RPG element to it that you saw in Castlevania 2 to a limited degree. Like, you gained experience and that would boost mm-hmm. your health points. But here, it's kind of transparent. You don't really see it, except that sometimes you'll kill an enemy and suddenly Alucard will get a level up. But then you start to acquire items throughout the castle, and suddenly you gain the ability to see how many points of damage you're inflicting on enemies. And suddenly you can like acquire things from candles, and it becomes more like, oh, there's some substance here. You start realizing that the money that you're collecting is not for points. It's actually something you can use at the shop run by a shopkeeper who will sell you potions and weapons and armors and maps and crystals and jewels and all kinds of things.
Yeah, I thought that was so awesome. The first time I ever played it, just going into the library, doesn't he say like, welcome, how can I help you or something like that?
Master Alucard,
yeah.
What brings you here? Something along those lines. Yeah, but
which is another
you don't really necessarily realize how much depth there is to this game, but it just kind of slowly unfolds and you start to realize, oh wow, there's a lot going on here that I did not expect. This is not just my father's Castlevania.
And the way that it teaches you this stuff is brilliant. You know, you talked about the prologue, Bloodlines with Richter, but there's basically a second prologue to that game, which is, you know, Alucard running through the woods, jumping into the castle closing behind you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, immediately you are taught there's only one way forward. You've already seen the place that you're going because you see Dracula's, little top of the stairs tower. You are given the opening hallways of Castlevania, which, like they usually do, are full of zombies. There's an infinite number of zombies. They will just spawn over and over until you leave the area. I mean, they'll continue spawning when you come back. But you can very easily level up once passing through that area. So it teaches you that immediately. You are given not the best set of equipment in the game, but some of the best equipment in the game at the start. So if you stop and check out the inventory, you will see the names of all these weapons and items. Those are then taken away from you. So you have the experience not just of knowing the theme of collecting these items back, gearing yourself up to go fight Dracula, but you are immediately shown the difference between the different kinds of attacks, because at the start of the game, you're armed with the Alucard sword. That's how you fight those zombies and level up a couple times. After you meet Death, and Death in a very continuity, canon-conscious way, isn't going to kill you, but he's also going to make it very difficult for you to progress through the castle. He takes away your weapons, and from that point until you get the drop from the bloody zombie on the third or fourth screen after that, you're punching. You're doing a different attack that has a different animation. Your cape is different because you're no longer wearing the cloak that you're wearing in your inventory. You're now back to this dull brown interior of the cape, which is a visual signifier that I don't know if that could have been done on an earlier generation. Like, I don't know if that's something that could have been done to the extent that it's done Symphony of the Night.
It would have involved like sprite layering and stuff.
Yeah. But you're given immediate visual and interactive cues to the way the inventory system works in a way that's incredibly brilliant. And also, one of the first secret rooms, not secret, but like you can't access it just yet, is above the area where you meet Death. So if you bother to look at your map, you see an empty space that should connect.
Oh, right, you mean there. The one in the gap in the bridge? You can actually get to that right away.
Can you get to that right away? I think you could land.
I did it last time I played. Jump. Like if you jump just right, you'll land on that ledge and there's like a heart container. Yeah. But then, you know, you get a little further in and once you have your weapon, you go to like a bigger room and there is a ledge above you.
There's a shaft that goes straight down to the point.
Right. And you can see there's like a wall that can only be broken from the other side. And there's like a weapon or something on the other side of that. And you're like, how can I get there? And you can't access it from that side, but you can loop back around later and break through the wall. So it gives you a shortcut. So it's doing the Dark Souls thing way before Dark Souls.
There is no game that I have ever played in my life that is better at putting things just out of reach. Everything is so close that you think you can make it, but not close enough that you can, and not so far away that you're like, well, screw this game. I don't want to play it. It's very tantalizing in the way that it presents things.
And then there are areas, like occasionally you'll come across things that you can get to if you figure out how right away. So in that, you know, that very first area, the alchemy lab, once you get your weapon, there's a switch that will cause this spikes. Like platform to descend.
Oh, okay.
And you can't trigger that and make it up and jump on the platform, the little elevator thing, in time to reach the area it reaches to, that it leads to. But what you can do is you can kill a Red Bones skeleton on top of the switch, and it will hold down the switch while it's defeated. And then you can run up and stand underneath the little elevator thing. And when the Red Bones revives and walks off the switch, its weight leaving the switch will cause the platform to descend. And if you time it just right, you can jump and then jump immediately and get up to this little area that you wouldn't normally be able to get to until later in the game. And there's a weapon in there that's, I think it's like a knife.
I think it's the Basilard.
Yeah. So it's like about as strong as your weapon that you already have, but it's faster and has a different range. So you can, you know, like if you're more into the speedy weapons, then you have another attack option to use against the first boss, which is in a few screens away.
And it's laid out so that when you come in, you see the bloody skeleton walk across that switch. There's right. So many good visual cues.
Yeah.
There's the first time you get to the outer wall, there's a mist could pass. Great. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think the first time you encounter one, you just go to mm-hmm. this thing, you get the message mist could pass, which you mm-hmm. don't at that point know that you will eventually be turning right. into mist.
I feel like that's the least elegant element of the game. Like
it is.
To say, hey, you need this power up. Everywhere else in the game is just like, figure it out. But there, I guess that's so subtle that they're like, yeah, you can do this later.
Well, but there's also a part. And I only know this because a friend of mine showed it to me the first time I played this game. Because I don't think there's any indication of it. But if you go to the room above that and go into the corner and just stand there for a few minutes, there's an elevator that drops you down and you get the jewel knuckles, which at that point in the game are a pretty good item. And so you're taught mist could pass, but you're also taught, hey, you're going to want to go through these mist grates. Eventually, there's going to be stuff you need behind here. And also, if you have a friend who shows you that, it's like, hey, there's going to be stuff that's just going to happen in this game. And that is that's a thing that you're going to have to be aware of. This, like, there are going to be things that aren't what they seem. It's all taught to you in a way that is as elegant as a Mario Brothers, like a game that is, as you have written about, Jeremy, like famously good at teaching you things screen by screen.
Yeah, when people talk about how this is a badly designed game, I just have to stop and like say,
who said that?
What is your idea of a what do you think good game design is? Do you not think that it's dangling information in front of you and giving you interesting, subtle hints and nudging you very gently to figure things out in a way that's, you know, that's intuitive and not vexing and never makes you feel like I'm stupid or this game is broken and there's nowhere to go? Like, this game is the definition of good game design. Yeah, there's some parts of it that could be better. Like, okay, maybe combat's too easy. Yeah, maybe the RPG leveling system is way unbalanced and it's easy to exploit, but that's not really the point of the game. It's about like finding your way through the castle and discovering this beautiful labyrinth and, you know, reaching the end and figuring out what the secret ending is about.
Yeah. And it's not just small rooms either. There's an entire section of the Long Library, which is already a pretty good sized chunk of real estate, but there's an it doubles in size when you get the double jump and there's a whole other mm-hmm. sprite set and whole new backgrounds behind it, which is a really good indication of how that game is going to go from there forward. Because, hey, surprise, not only is it super well designed, super cohesive, there's a second game. There's an entirely other game in there that also they don't tell you about until it happens.
Favorite little set pieces from this game is in the chapel, where you can sit down on a chair and a ghost comes out.
Oh, in the confessional?
Priest, yeah.
The confessional
comes out.
And different times. One time he gives you something, and then another time he'll shoot spikes at you.
If it's a black robed priest, he'll chuckle, and then he'll stab you with not just a knife, but like a ton of weapons come out of the confessional booth. If it's a green priest, I think he'll just be like, he'll do his rosary.
He sits and listens.
I think the blue priest will actually give you the Eucharist.
Yeah,
like,
he'll give you grapes
or something. Grapes, yeah.
Because it's communion wine.
That is brilliant. And also that just in the context of that game, even though it's just a 2D cartoony game by any other standard, it's really creepy and kind of terrifying that one of them will try to kill you with this, that, and then they disappear. I love those details. There's so many details packed into it.
Well, because I think it's...
there's a whole other vampire living in Dracula's castle, Olrox, who's a reference to Nosferatu.
Yeah, Count Orlok.
Yeah, the black and white ancient vampire movie from the 20s, the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And he's waiting for you to banquet table. And if you run up and attack him, he'll start fighting. But he's just sitting there, and there's a chair at the other side. You can sit in any chair in this game that you find.
That's amazing.
So you can actually just go to the boss's lair and sit at the table opposite him, and you're not actually doing anything, but it's having a genteel moment with your adversary before you enter mortal combat and he turns into a giant slobbering demon.
Yeah, and the bit in the confessional is, I believe, I'm not sure about this, it might be random, and it might just be how it played out for me last time I played it when I was really paying attention. I believe you get the priest who does the item drop first.
Yeah, I think so.
So, and you can also...
So you think you can keep doing it to get good stuff.
If you get greedy, you get attacked. And you can also sit as the priest and confessors will come in.
There's one
who tries to kill you. You wrote a really good piece about, Jeremy, about how there's so much unnecessary stuff in that game. You don't have to be that game would be great and brilliant without being able to sit in chairs, but you can.
And there are dozens of items that don't really do much other than add to the universe of the game. Mm-hmm. Remember those shoes that add 1 pixel to your height?
That's brilliant. Always one of my favorites.
Brilliant.
And
I remember that because the first time I played this was the first game I ever imported and had my PlayStation modded to play this game. And I did not read much Japanese at the time. So I was kind of bumbling my way through, but I had a friend who is an exchange student, and she came over and was watching me play. And I was like, so can you help me figure out what these things do? And so I brought up the shoes, and she read the inventory description, and she started giggling. And she was like, oh, these just make you look taller. I was like, are you sure about that? And she was like, yeah, that's what it says. So... it came to English, and it just said, secret shoes discreetly increased his height.
And I think you get those, because those are behind the waterfall, if memory serves.
I believe so, yeah.
I don't know if you've got the double jump at that point yet in the game. So I remember personally being like, is this what's going to get me to that ledge?
I don't know.
No, it is absolutely
You have to
not.
Have the holy symbol to be able to get past the waterfall. Otherwise, you'll take damage and be flung away because it's
true.
Water.
There's all these mushrooms you can collect, and isn't there some kind of glasses or something cool glasses?
There's sunglasses that they look cool, but and they give you a point of defense, but they lower your intelligence.
Yeah, that's neat.
There's all these little subtle things built into the descriptions and the stats and all kinds of weird stuff you can do. Yeah, the familiars.
There's a cape. Before we stop talking about the items, there's a cape you can get that you can change the color of, an RGB.
It's Joseph's cloak.
Joseph.
Biblical
reference there.
This game would be brilliant without familiars at all, but that there are familiars, and they do things. Mm-hmm. The bat gets a heart over his head when you turn into a bat. The sword becomes an item, which again, it just goes away at one point when you're leveling it up. Which is
level 90, though. You have to really go for it.
You do. I think it's level 50.
Oh, 50?
But you can continue. The longer you level it up, the more powerful it gets, both as a familiar and as an item you can equip.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So there's still stuff I'm discovering about this game. So many years
And when you do the special attack with it, it leaves behind the word verboten.
Really?
I don't know why.
That's a different sword.
Oh, is it?
That's the...
It's the verboten sword.
I guess.
Oh, what's the name? It's not the heaven sword, but it's the other one. Yeah.
Yeah,
If you pause it on its swing, verboten is written in the so
game.
Friggin' good.
there are probably a lot of inside jokes tucked away in there. I wonder how long this took to develop. It must have taken a long time.
I don't know.
It,
it's interesting because the lead designer on it, Toru Hagiwara, was like a longtime veteran developer at Konami. He had worked on a bunch of other Castlevania games. And I guess he was boosted to management heaven midway through. And so that's when Koji Igarashi took over. So despite the fact that this game had sort of like a change in leadership midway through, apparently, it still came out really cohesive and really imaginative.
And it's got that Amano portraits for all the characters.
No, it's
no, it's not Amano.
Ayami Kojima.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Amano did Final Fantasy, right? Yeah. But they're so gothically stylistic. Everything about it is beautiful. Like, the aesthetic is beautiful. The gameplay is beautiful. At heart, the Metroidvania layout, like, you can depict it with sticks. It's just various floating sticks. But Symphony of the Night presents all of those floating platforms in a way where, much like the original Castlevania, they connect to the background in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, there's like spiral staircases.
There's broken stairs that explain why you can't just walk into the background.
Yeah, the whole the outer keep where the platforms crumble as you make your way across, so you can't actually get through until you have the double jump. Mm-hmm. Like, everything there kind of makes physical sense. Like, oh, I see why this broke. I see why this fell.
Yeah. It's a wonderfully made game.
It's hard to top something, a game with so much packed into it like that. Just so much depth and level to it. And then we didn't really mention the inverted castle. You may have alluded to it, but the fact that, you know, once you beat it with a certain item?
You have to, because the Dark Priest Shaft. First of all, you have to go fight the Dark Priest Shaft. And also, that middle clock room where things happen in the in-game clock every minute or every hour or when you use the item that stops time, that's brilliant. Then getting the items that, you know, wear clock in tower on the rings.
Yeah.
You have to do that to go fight Shaft. Then you get the glasses. Then you go fight Richter. And if you put the glasses on, which they have no like defense benefit whatsoever, I don't think, you can see the orb that's controlling him. And you have to kill that without killing him, which is ridiculously good design.
There's like three or four different endings. If you defeat Richter without knowing about the orb, it's like, oh, this seems sad and it's a shame this happened. But if you know about the orb and can see it and still kill Richter, then it's like, man, that was bad. That shouldn't have happened at all.
I think I first beat the game and just killed Richter and that was it. And I didn't play it again for a few years. And then I read that you could do the inverted castle thing. And I went back and I was like, holy crap, it's a whole nother game.
Cause with most games that have that kind of setup, you just get the good ending, right? Castlevania gives you literally 100% more game. Like you get the,
yeah,
100.3, I think.
100.3.
200.3.
You get the entire castle flipped over with new villains, with a different like sprite
set. Yeah, some of the coolest stuff is in there, like Gallimoth, which is a reference to the final boss of Kid Dracula, of all damn things, is like this crazy hard boss, unless you have the right equipment, in which case he becomes trivial. He fires lightning at you constantly, so if you have the thing that absorbs lightning...
Oh, the barrel circlet?
Yeah. Then you basically can't be hurt by him. But I didn't know that, playing in Japanese. So I did this painstaking playthrough where I kept turning into mist anytime he cast lightning and then would turn back and attack while I could. And then I would turn back into mist again. And then I'd have to recharge my magic points because it sucks so much magic. But I painstakingly beat him the hard way. It's possible. And there's like Beelzebub, the Lord of Flies,
Beelzebub,
which is like a rotting corpse hanging on a bunch of meat hooks, and enormous flies are coming out of the screen and attacking you while he drops maggots that turn into more flies. It's super gross.
Legitimately one of the best and most thrilling bosses in the entire franchise and in games in general.
Yeah, the boss fights are great in that game.
Yeah.
I'll make one last point about this game for me is that I mentioned this on the first Metroidvania episode, is that this was the first game where an action platformer where I could spend the time to level up my character so it would actually be easier for me to play through the game and not so punishing. And I really, really loved that. So I could, you know, sort of do some grinding on some lower level monsters to raise my attack and defense. And that would, it just made the game easier. And I love that the flexibility that you could do that. You could do anything you wanted. You can configure it any way you want it. You put your equipment any way you want it. You can play it any way you want it. And it's just so much flexibility. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. It's a great game. All right. Well, yeah, I know you guys.
You can beat Gallimoth without the right equipment.
You can. It's not advisable. Don't do it. Anyway, I know you guys need to get going because rush hour and life and stuff like that. So I think it's time to wrap and call it a day. But this has been a fun and interesting discussion. I'm glad you guys finally got to talk about Symphony of the Night. I hope you will still come back for future episodes.
Well, our next episode is going to be a continuation of this, right? It's the inverted discussion.
There is one more Metroidvania episode in the bag, and that is the indie resurgence of the past decade or so. And we'll get to that in a few months. Yeah. But in the meantime, this has been Metroidvania Part 5. We're going to finish this off someday, I swear to God. I've been Jeremy Parrish for Retronauts. You can find Retronauts at iTunes, Retronauts.com, and Podcast One. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can support Retronauts by listening to the show, of course. It's free. Or you can go to Patreon and subscribe for $3 a month, in which case you will get access to every episode without commercials at a higher bit rate a week in advance of the public broadcast or distribution of the episodes, which I think is a pretty cool deal. So check that out. Patreon.com/retronauts. Chris.
You can find everything that I do by going to the-isb.com. That's the Invincible Superblog, my website. That's got links to the comic books that I write, as well as the columns that I write around the web and the podcast that I do. That are very fun to listen to. My final thought is put it on the Switch, you cowards.
That goes for not just this game, but every game, right?
Every game ever made. But especially Symphony of the Night. I would pay $60 to play Symphony of the Night on the Switch.
They'll take you up on it. They'll add microtransactions.
Only if it's 16:9 ratio. I'm not paying for it. Yeah. They could just easily.
The game wasn't designed for that.
So they can redesign it.
Just give me a little border with that cool portrait of Alucard.
Yes. Or the succubus.
The topless succubus, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Actually, you know what would be really cool is if the if they did reissue it and they included a translated version of the manga that Ayami Kojima created for the special edition of the Japanese release. Saturn? There's like a 16... No, the PlayStation one.
Really?
Came with a soundtrack CD that had like the best cuts from Castlevania's history and also a book that had lots of art and then like a 16-page manga in which Alucard awakens and is like, whoa, what's up, dad? It's pretty cool. I'd love to see that translated and put into an official product. Hint, hint, Konami.
Yep.
Benj.
I'm Benj Edwards. You can listen to my new podcast, The Culture of Tech, at theculturetech.com. I have guests like Steve Wozniak and Richard Garriott, and I really appreciate your support.
All right, and that wraps it up for this episode. Please join us again next week for another episode. And, of course, on an upcoming Friday, probably next Friday, I don't know, for another micro-episode. That's what we do. Anyway, I'm wiped out. It's been a long afternoon. Good night, everyone.
Good night.